Hello listeners, will you allow me a minute to tell you about Past Test? If you haven't used them yet, you should. They are a fantastic online resource with hundreds of questions and answers covering multiple medical exams, including the MRCS, MRCP and medical finals. I've used them lots and found the resource so useful, particularly the past papers for these exams. As a listener to the podcast, you lucky people get 15% off some of these subscriptions. So don't wait around. I mean, do until the end of the episode, but then go and get your access. Links and codes will be in the show notes. Who will a dim bone, dim bone, dim
drive on? Welcome to MRCS on the Move. Bowels, bones, and backseat vibers. I'm your host, Naomi, but this is the podcast where you do the talking. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Bowels, Bones, and Backseat Vibers. It's fabulous to be back with you all. I hope you're all doing great and having a good day, whether you're on the way to work, on the way home, whatever you're doing. So I am very excited to introduce another special guest to you all. I have Dr. Leo Watton with me today. He is a general surgical registrar currently working in Yorkshire and with me at York. And we had the pleasure of doing core training together, although didn't, well, kind of work together, didn't we, Leo? Kind of. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good, good, good. Leo has today been introduced to Darcy, who some of you have heard about, with the intention of potentially getting a visitor, and I think she's slowly putting him off by the look of his face.
Oh, yeah. But we'll see if she behaves herself tonight.
Exactly, yeah. She's currently sat relatively quietly, but we'll see. So I've got Leo on board today to do an episode on biliary disease, which I guess you're now a pro at being a registrar, right?
Yeah. I'm not sure about that.
Ah, no. Back yourself. I'm sure you are. So we'll go over similar things to normal. A bit of anatomy, a bit of the function of the gallbladder, and then we're going to go through some different acute presentations. So, shall we crack on? Are you ready?
Let's go for it.
Good, good, good. So, a little bit of anatomy. What are the surface markings of the gallbladder? And where does it lie in relation to the liver?
So surface markings of the gallbladder, the most important thing for you to know really is that the tip of the ninth costal cartilage is clinically relevant because that's where you'll elicit Murphy's sign. So if you imagine drawing a line between the right-sided anterior superior iliac spine and the umbilicus, and then get a point halfway between the two, and then just go directly superior, that will get you to the tip of the ninth costal cartilage. So that's the important surface marking in relation to the gallbladder. As far as where it lives, in relation to the liver, it sits kind of just inferior underneath the liver. The liver actually has a specific region called the gallbladder fossa. So the gallbladder fossa is an area just inferior to the liver. It's just below segment 5, and there are different degrees to which the gallbladder kind of sits in this area that you see intraoperatively. So sometimes you'll see a lot of the gallbladder when you put your laparoscope in, sometimes you won't see much of it depending on kind of how intrahepatic the gallbladder is.
Okay, great. So if you could describe the structure of the biliary tree and the different parts of the gallbladder.
So the biliary tree starts from like a microscopic level. It starts with small canaliculi that kind of all form together almost like a river forming, and the ducts get slightly larger, and these tributary ducts form a right and left hepatic duct. They then come together to form the common hepatic duct, and that becomes the common bile duct when joined by the cystic duct from the gallbladder. The common bile duct then has a path that goes behind the duodenum, just over the top of the pancreas, and joins the pancreatic duct at the ampulla of vata, where it enters to, and that's where your bile comes into the alimentary tract. The gallbladder itself has a few different areas that you'll see in your textbooks. It has the fundus, which is the kind of the end part of it, the bag part of it, the body, Hartmann's pouch, which is right at the base of the fundus, going into the neck of the gallbladder, where it then becomes the cystic duct and joins up to become the common bile duct.
Fabulous. So what is the name of the important landmark identified during a lap coli, and what does it form? Why is it important? Big question, lots of questions.
So I think what you're referring to is when you try to achieve what's called the critical view of safety.
Oh.
It's an important step of doing a cholecystectomy, because this is the bit where you're identifying the anatomy before you cut, or before you clip and cut anything. This being a really high risk part of the procedure, because if you cut the wrong thing, like the common bile duct, and your patient's in some real bother. So what you try and establish in this anatomy is something called the hepatocystic triangle. Importantly, this is not, I repeat, this is not Callow's triangle.
Oh, that's what I thought the answer was. It's not. This is why I get special guests.
If you get the opportunity, obviously not while you're driving your car, get on Google and just look for a picture of the hepatocystic triangle. And almost all of them will show you Callow's triangle as well. And they're very slightly different things. So the hepatocystic triangle, which is the important thing that we need to know about, is a triangle formed by the inferior border of the liver, the cystic duct, and the common hepatic duct.
Mm.
And in that triangle, usually, or it should always be, the cystic artery that runs through there. And therefore, we've already identified the cystic duct, which is, a single duct, tubular structure that runs onto the gallbladder, and we can identify that piece of anatomy. And then we have the cystic artery, which runs right through the middle of the hepatocystic triangle. And when we can see those two tubular structures, and only those two tubular structures and nothing else, then you can confidently clip and cut those things. Now, the Callow's triangle is something very fractionally different. I won't bore you with it. I would suggest Googling it instead, and it will make sense to you. But although we all hear about Callow's triangle, it's not really very clinically relevant at all.
Ah.
So, a bit of homework for everyone.
And me, yeah. Not that I need to know about it anymore, actually. Okay, so last question on anatomy. What is the blood supply, and why does this make it rare that the gallbladder becomes gangrenous?
So, the gallbladder takes its blood supply from the rest of the foregut structures, so that means that it comes from the celiac axis. The celiac axis is a slightly complicated vascular anatomy. Again, it's one to get up in a decent anatomy textbook or something like that. But in brief, the common hepatic artery comes off the celiac axis, forms the hepatic proper, and then the right hepatic and the cystic artery. So basically, the blood supply is just really good to the gallbladder. Sometimes it can get very small tributaries from other areas as well. But because the blood supply, as with most foregut structures, is so good, it means that almost never do you get kind of an ischemic gallbladder from a thrombotic or vascular type event.
Mm-hmm. Lucky gallbladder. We have to keep that in. One of those really cringy things that I say. So as long as I can make you look stupid at some point.
That'll be funny, that, don't worry.
Right, moving on to the function of the gallbladder. We're going to skip a little bit over some in-depth physiology, or we'll be here forever, but we'll move straight on to sort of the gallstones. What are the most common types of gallstones?
So by far the most common are cholesterol stones, which obviously are made up of fat. You can also get pigment stones, which are made from bile, basically. And then you can get mixed stones as well.
And why do they form, Leo?
Well, There's a variety of risk factors that are involved, but if you think about the two main different types being cholesterol and pigment stones, you have to think a little bit about why you may get the factors that contribute to it. So for example, cholesterol stones are much more common if a patient is overweight. Pigment stones are much more common if someone has, you know, high turnover of red cells. So for example, if they've got autoimmune hemolytic anemias, all that kind of stuff. So that's one reason, amongst others, why you have to take a pretty thorough history to try and dig into if they have any of those risk factors that are attached to it. But on top of those, there can be other contributory factors like a kind of chemical imbalance. So for example, in patients who have Crohn's disease or who have terminal islet receptions, they get a very rapid change in how much fat they can resorb, because that's where the micelles tend to resorb most of the fat. So if you get a sudden change in those circumstances and a change in the chemical balance of your bile, then stones can proliferate out from there.
Great. So you touched on it a little bit, but what are the risk factors for getting stones, and in that sort of who commonly gets them?
So there's the kind of four, five or six F's, depending on how many you see or read about. But in general, it's fat, overweight people with fair hair, fair skin, who are in their 40s or 50s or fertile and female. So they're the kind of high risk patients. But to be honest, from my experience, pretty much anyone can get them. I've seen them in children, I've seen them in elderly patients, I've seen them presenting at all sorts of different stages of life. So kind of always be suspicious of someone with epigastric or right-sided pain that it could be related to gallstones.
Do you think that's... I saw a couple of kids having with gallstones on my last general surgical job. Do you think that's becoming more common, sadly?
I don't know. And I mean, you might have thought it might be common if people are overweight or what have you, but in my experience, albeit brief, of those kids, they weren't particularly overweight. But I mean, you know, I'm sure there's a hereditary thing that plays into it as well. And then, as I mentioned before, you know, certain patients will have their own risk factors, you know, autoimmune hemolytic anemias, those kind of things. So they're ones to be aware of too.
Great. So should we move on to the clinical stuff?
Let's go for it.
So we're going to set out a bit of a story today. Me trying to be creative. So you are the general surgical reg on call. Your F2 tells you that there's a 55-year-old female patient who's presented with right upper quadrant pain and nausea. No other information is given to you at this point. Give me a big long list of all the differentials and how you would structure your answer, please.
Well, that's very open-ended, isn't it? Yeah. Which is good, it's brilliant. So I think there's a couple of different ways you can approach this. There's the kind of the classic surgical sieve, where you can think about, you know, neoplastic, autoimmune, ischemic, inflammatory pathologies. The one that I've kind of always tended to use, especially when you're talking about tummy pain in different areas, is to think about what different systems live in and around those areas, or what different organs live in and around those areas. So the way that I would break it down is thinking about, obviously we're talking about biliary stuff now, so you can think about, well, what could possibly be going wrong with the gallbladder? Could it be biliary colic? Could it be cholecystitis? Could it be cholangitis? You can think about specific hepatic things. So could it be, hepatitis, could it be an ischemic hepatitis, infective hepatitis, autoimmune hepatitis, could it be primary sclerosing cholangitis?
You sound like you could go on forever.
And then think about other stuff as well. So things that can go wrong with your stomach, your duodenum, your small bowel, your right colon, the chest, the number of times you see chest infections in patients with right upper quadrant pain, so another good reason to do an erect chest x-ray, for all these patients. Loads of pancreatitis. Mm. I literally could go on forever. But that's my preference, to think about the organs that are there.
Yeah, I used to prefer that as well. Think organs rather than the surgical sieve is the answer everyone gives, but I preferred it that way. I'll prefer it that way.
I feel like I probably miss out fewer things with this way.
Yeah. I just think it's more logical. It's more, for me anyway.
Yeah, but.
Okay, so now you're told that she's had this pain before. It typically gets worse after she has a takeaway or a big nice cheese board or something. What's jumped to the top of your differentials? I'm going to give this answer. It's biliary colic. Because that's what I want you to talk about next. Okay, so what is the cause of biliary colic? Go for it, Leo.
So biliary colic is the kind of this intractable pain that you get for, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes. This is squeezing, you know, specific colic pain the patient's getting in the right upper quadrant. It's because the gallbladder is contracting onto these, you know, hard stones. And it comes from when your stomach releases the chyme into the small bowel. It stimulates the eye cells, which are these enteroendocrine cells. Basically, they get a little bit irritated and produce cholecystokinin. Choly meaning gallstones, gallbladder, whatever. Cyst meaning the bladder part of it. And then kinin meaning move. So it breaks down into literally, you know, move the gallbladder.
Do you want to do my gastric physiology?
No. Gallbladder physiology only.
Okay. Sorry, I interrupted you. Were you finished?
So that's why there is sometimes a bit of a brief delay, because nothing's getting out of the stomach for at least a short period of time, and before then things get along and start being stimulated.
Okay. So what is Hartmann's pouch? I think this feels like another answer where you're going to go, it's not really what you think it is.
No, it's not. This one, you know.
It is what you think it is.
So we did briefly discuss it earlier, but it's a specific region of the gallbladder, which is just before the neck. And it's important because this is a bit where stones often go and sit in, and they can get stuck there, and they can essentially obstruct the outlet of the gallbladder, which is one of the reasons why the inflammatory process of cholecystitis can be initiated. It's a little region where gallstones can commonly go and sit.
So I think you've probably touched on a lot of this, but typical symptoms, the ones that you just find that might make you think this is a simple biliary colic, do you guys want to just list a couple of them out?
So obviously right upper quadrant pain,
yeah.
And the pattern of the pain is really important. Again, taking a really clear history is really important at this point. And there's lots of important negatives, you know, not having, well, I won't go into the other details of it because we'll probably cover that later. But there's important negatives, and we'll pick up on those things in a bit. But yes, pain primarily, it can often be accompanied by nausea, but these things should settle down. They've often had episodes of this before. You may well be seeing these patients because they're presenting having had a number of episodes and they just can't deal with it anymore. And often by the time you've got round to seeing them in A&E or whatever it is, their symptoms have calmed back down again.
And they're on a very long waiting list for
Abcoli. Yeah. To be fair, York is not too bad.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they're quite good at getting them done, so York's not bad.
Oh, there we go. Don't all go to York, please.
They'll all come to York.
They will not forgive us.
Loads of gallbladders here in York. Please come here.
Okay, so we'll talk about investigation. Management is essentially pain relief, and they need Labcoli at some point. You investigate it basically with an ultrasound. Am I correct?
Pretty much.
And you'd want bloods and all that sort of thing, but we're going to touch on that bit.
Yeah, this is going to be like exam practice, isn't it? So whenever someone says, you know, how would you investigate / manage these patients, it's always got to be A to E, you know, make sure the patient's safe, all that stuff. But in brief, as you say, give them some good painkillers, give them a bit of antiemetic if they need it, get an ultrasound at some point, especially if they've obviously not had one before, but if they've not had one for a period of time, then I would get a repeat one. The other thing to bear in mind is that if these patients have normal ultrasound, sometimes gastritis can present very similarly. So if they've got a normal ultrasound, do an OGD, and the same the other way around, if patients have had normal OGDs, do an ultrasound. Mm-hmm. Just something to bear in mind.
Yeah. Okay, so you're fairly happy that you're going to absolutely nail this diagnosis, and you start to tell the F2 to just give her some pain relief, outpatient ultrasound, as we said, discharge. You'll be a little bit helpful and you'll book the patient for their lap colo. And then the nurse comes up to you and says, "Oi, doctor, you've forgotten to look at her OBS." So she says, "Oh, she's actually tachycardic and she's got a temperature of 38.5. So, drum roll, what are we thinking now? Go for it, you can just tell us.
Well, so, obviously, we're now going to talk about cholecystitis.
We are.
But a word should come before that, and it should be sepsis.
Oh. Shouldn't it? Are you changing mind?
Yeah, let's talk about sepsis. But, you know, again, exam answers. You've got somebody who's tachycardic, yep. It's pyrexial, they've got this dysregulated host response. This should be sepsis, shouldn't it? And obviously, you know, I guess one thing if you're preparing for your part B as well is that you can steer the conversation in your 10-minute vivas. So if you know a bit about sepsis and you want to ramble on about it for a while and go and get yourself some points, then do it by all means. But yes, cholecystitis, very possibly.
Very possibly. So what is acute cholecystitis?
So acute cholecystitis is an inflammatory condition of the gallbladder, commonly bacterial in nature. There are two types of cholecystitis. By far and away the more common is calculus cholecystitis, i.e. those patients who have gallstones. But there's also acalculus cholecystitis, those patients who don't have gallstones. These are often patients who are unwell for other reasons, burns patients, often they're in ICU, these types of patients. And the pathology behind it is quite different. But yeah, for the purposes of this, what we'll talk about is calculus cholecystitis, I presume.
Yes, we will focus on calculus. So what are the typical features? And this might be where we talk about some of those negatives that we alluded to a moment ago.
So these patients have pain. That is almost always a feature of their history. They usually have right upper quadrant pain. That beware, they can present with right lower quadrant pain. They can present with epigastric pain. They can present with right flank pain. They are commonly nauseous and or vomiting. Sometimes they may have a temperature. Importantly, these patients with just cholecystitis and not any other biliary pathology shouldn't have any evidence of jaundice. And in the history, it's worth digging into, you know, how have their bowels been, how are their water works, asking about the colours and the potential for the change in those colours if they've got obstructive jaundice. So those patients shouldn't have any of these unless they've been unlucky and had some past stones in the recent times. But yeah, shouldn't have any of those symptoms.
Okay. Can you name some complications of acute cholecystitis?
So I guess we've covered the most common one already, which is sepsis.
Again, that wasn't on my list. You just...
It is a complication.
It is. He's definitely right. He just... When I said, "Do you have any additions to the... to the script?" You didn't. You thought, "I'll keep that one up my sleeve and just whack it out."
Yeah. So sepsis is a really common one. Gallbladder empyemas are common too. So we discussed that sometimes the gallbladder outlet can get obstructed. If that big pocket then becomes a big ball of pus, then you get a gallbladder empyema. These patients can sometimes perforate their gallbladders. And in taking your history, they might say, "Oh yeah, I've had this grumbling pain for 3 or 4 days, and then suddenly it got significantly worse," and that's probably the event at which it perforated. And then in some patients, they can go on to develop chronic cholecystitis. So they have this grumbling, ongoing soreness. So these are the ones where you really don't want to have to take the gallbladder out because it's horrible. And I guess the final thing is that
you know, they do commonly, unfortunately, with the waiting list and what have you, represent with acute cholecystitis often on more than one occasion before we get the opportunity to take the gallbladder out. But that's another topic in itself as to maybe we should have taken the gallbladder out straight away. Not for
now. Oh, acute versus delayed.
The guidelines would say take the gallbladder out on the index admission if they get in within the right number of days, but for another day.
Well, the next question is, how are you going to manage them in your world? Perfect guidelines.
So as before, you know, septic patients, so the sepsis bundle. And then, yeah, you know, A to E, resuscitate your patient, all that kind of stuff. But specifically about the management of cholecystitis, a broad spectrum antibiotics in the first instance, usually with some intravenous fluid as well, as we've discussed already in your sepsis management. Give them some good painkillers, give them some good antiemetics on a regular basis. Commonly they'll require an admission to hospital. Not always the case, but commonly they will. And at that point you can take the opportunity to get an ultrasound scan. In patients who are really unwell, you're not unsure of the diagnosis or what have you, or you're suspicious of a perforation, you can think about doing a CT scan sooner rather than later. CT is not particularly good at picking up gallstones. It will pick up the inflammation of cholecystitis, but doesn't necessarily pick up gallstones because if they're made of fat, then they won't be able to be spotted on the CT scan. But yeah, so otherwise, ultrasound scan. The guidelines currently say that, it depends which one you read, but in brief, if you get admitted to hospital and you're an inpatient within 5 days of symptoms, we should be able to offer you a cholecystectomy, presuming that your liver function tests are normal and we've got evidence of you having cholecystitis. In some good upper GI centres, you may not even have to have normal liver function tests. They might do on-table cholangiograms, CBD exploration, all sorts of other stuff. With various pressures and what have you, it's not uncommon that the initial episode gets managed conservatively, and then we have to delay doing a cholecystectomy for about 6 to 8 weeks until things all calm down, because otherwise you put patients at even higher risk of injury when you come to do their operation.
Did you say it was in? You want to do it within sort of 5 days?
Yeah, so it depends which guidelines you read, but in general it's between about 5 and 7 days of the onset of symptoms. If you present within that window, which most people do, then we should be able to offer you a cholecystectomy.
Yeah, fabulous. So we are going to pause this episode here. You have given your patient antibiotics, you're going to admit them, keep them overnight, and you're going to request some blood tests in the morning. And we'll see you back for the next episode to find out what happens with this patient. Okay. So thanks for listening, guys. We will speak to you again soon. Oh, and thanks, Leo. I should probably say thanks for being here. But,
my pleasure.
Yeah. Okay. Bye-bye. Oh, well, a dim bone, dim bone, dim. Try bone.